Now trending with Andrea Elias and Orla Johannes on CJAD 800.
I got that sunshine in my pocket. Got that good soul in my feet. I feel that hot blood in my body when it drops.
Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us. I'm Orla.
And I'm Andrea. Coming up on today's show, are you thinking about your next vacation? Montreal Gazette and Post Media travel columnist Rochelle Lash is going to join us to chat about the latest trend of all-inclusive luxury resorts. And just how healthy is salmon? And are all varieties created the same? Do they all have the same benefits? Stephanie Colombo, an associate professor and research chair in aquaculture nutrition at Dalhousie University in Halifax, is going to weigh in on this.
Plus, we'll take a look at the top wedding trends for 2024 with wedding expert Alison McGill. But first, January is nearly turning its corner. And maybe so have your New Year's fitness resolutions. We're in the thick of winter and staying motivated to exercise can be really difficult at this time of the year for even the most active person. So what are some simple things that we can do to keep moving and keep our bodies in shape at this time of year? Joining us now is Kieron Frail, behavioral scientist based in beautiful California. Welcome back to the show, Kieron.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's good to be on.
Well, this is a very tough time of year. I mean, you know, for people like Andrea and I, where we're up to our ears in coldness and snow and damp weather, what advice can you offer to keep ourselves motivated to exercise during the winter?
Great question. And I think it's a great time for this, right? It's at the end of January. We've had those New Year's resolutions and it's becoming more and more difficult. And I think I'd start by saying, you know, there's different forms of motivation. There's extrinsic motivation, these external goals that a lot of us set at the start of the year that we want to lose a certain amount of pounds or you know, get so fast in our run. But there's also more internal motivation. I think that's what I would focus on as we talk today about how to stay motivated. Those internalized forms of motivation are usually the ones that we are able to sustain more, and research would suggest we can keep those going longer. So things like that would be finding fun in our exercise and finding fun in the way the types of movements that we do.
Yeah. So is that particular to the activity you're doing? Like, should you be looking for something you love to do rather than something, you know, you just feel like you kind of have to do?
So I think, again, a great question. And I think, you know, it depends. It's finding fun. We can find fun in different ways. It might be the people that we do it with. It might be the type of activity. And sometimes it's also even just newness can help, something new and different. So I think that this time of year is wonderful for looking at new forms of activity that maybe we haven't done before. Because oftentimes we find something that we like or we think we like. So, you know, let's, for example, think of someone who loves to run in the summer and so on. I think for those types of people, you can definitely continue to run in the winter, but it's hard, right? It's cold outside. Maybe you don't like to run the treadmill. So sometimes we could consider using this time of year for exploring other types of activities that might actually contribute to your summer running when it starts up again. So you might think about doing yoga or, you know, boxing or kickboxing or something that you haven't done before. And it doesn't mean that you have to do it forever, but it's a great time to find these new activities. And there's lots of new ways to do it. Lots of gyms put on offers at this time of year. There's things like ClassPass that allow you to try different things. So I think this is, you know, sometimes we think of winter as a time where we just have to struggle through, but we can also look at it as a time of opportunity to do new things and to build, you know, to build our bodies back up and to make them strong and ready for when the weather does get better.
Kieron, that's great advice. I do have to say, though, when I'm driving around right now and I see these, you know, all done up people jogging and it's minus good knows what, I feel like stopping the car, pulling over and saying, I'm so happy for you. You're an inspiration, but I'm still not going to do it. I mean,
you should.
I'm so proud of these people. I wouldn't do it myself, but I'm so proud that there are those people that are so motivated when it's so cold to go out for a jog. Now, Ciaran, I know, you know, it has been said that the time of day that we exercise is very important. But, you know, in the winter months, it's very dark. In the summer, I was quite enthusiastic to hop out and get on the step machine and drive to the gym. But in the winter months, you know, it does have that negative effect with the darkness and the cold. So how important is the time of day when it comes to working out?
So the time of day, I think there's two components of it, right? There's the time of day that maybe is best for the for your body and you might get the most benefits. But there's also the time of day that you're willing to do it. Right? And I think maybe that's what you're getting at is any time of day that you can move your body is great. And any type of movement. So for me at this time of year, you know, oftentimes we say that working out earlier in the day maybe is better for certain people because there's a physiological response inside that's better. But really at this time of the year, you know, I think sometimes people think, oh, I have to get up and get out at this time. But it's really hard, right? When it's especially when it's colder and that it can be very difficult. So anytime for me at this time of year, when it's dark and when it's cold outside, just finding the time that works and is sustainable. So maybe, again, go back to what you do in the summer when it's brighter. It might be different to what you do in the winter. And maybe in the summer when it's bright, you say, oh, I'm going to get up and get out before it gets too warm. I'm going to enjoy that. But in the winter, you say, you know what, I'm actually going to, you know, give myself a bit of a break. And instead of doing the morning run, then I'm going to do an afternoon workout on my way home from work. And I'll go to a gym or I'll go to a bike or maybe I'll just come home and do a yoga class, or I'll do something like that in the evening when I've warmed up and I'm feeling more energized. So it's a great time to explore. And I think the last thing I'll say in that is that we constantly want to evaluate and reevaluate and say, you know, maybe I realize that I've been trying to get up in the mornings all these times, and that's not really the time for me. So it's a great time to try different times of day, different activities and different approaches.
How important are the results, whether it be how you look or how you feel, when it comes to staying motivated with exercise?
They're important because that's what drives us oftentimes, and we like to think that aesthetics, you know, are not important. But I think how you feel ultimately, it's all wrapped up in that.
Definitely.
And I think in terms of motivation, finding joy is really good, and aesthetics are hard because. We always want more. Human nature, unfortunately, you know, is very critical. And we might say, oh, I want to lose 5 pounds. But then when you lose those 5 pounds, then what is there? Or you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And that if that's yourself, then we're also often hypercritical as well. So finding things that are joyous and you want to have that, right? So you want your body to feel better. But oftentimes, if that's the only thing, it becomes very difficult. So if you can find a way for that to be also, you know, fun, not, it doesn't have to be always fun, right? It's hard. Sometimes it's a bit of a grind. Sometimes we just have to get on that step machine and just put our time in. But but there's also the element for it to sustain that. We say, you know what, after, you know, this leads to this next thing where I'm going to go to a class once a week with my friend. And it doesn't have to be every day. Workout buddies are wonderful, but it's also hard to schedule. But if you have one class at the weekend, that can really motivate you for the rest of the week because you want to, you know, you want to do well week over week. So I think it's a combination of all of these things.
I'm just going to be really honest here, Andrea and Ciaran. You're like, oh God, what is she going to say? But you know what, Ciaran? I think you hit the nail on the head there for me. Listen, I work out because I want to look good in that dress when I go out to dinner on Friday night. I'm just going to say it how it is. Am I doing it as well because it's healthy and good for me? Yes. But primarily, I like to work out because it makes you look good and makes me feel good. There, I said it.
Listen,
judge
there's
me
also,
how you want, people.
I'm with you. I'm with you. There's definitely a level of vanity. But I do have to say, as I'm getting older, I am appreciating more feeling strong and having my energy levels also go along with that. Like, it's nice. Like, I know if I'm in better shape and eating well, my energy levels are better. And I think as we get older, there's definitely something to be said about that. We have so much to ask you.
We're arguing over you now, Ciaran. Andrea, go ahead, lovey.
I was just, you know, we have less than a minute left. I just wanted to ask you on something you just touched on about the social aspect. You know, I think during the pandemic, we saw a lot of people building home gyms or signing up for like on-demand workout platforms. Do you think the social component is really important to stay motivated as well?
You know, I think so. I think it's always been a big part. And some people are great working out by themselves. And ultimately, I think the home gym movement has been positive overall because now we have these things at home that can support it. But I think social is just great. It's great for all aspects. And I think post-COVID, many of us struggle. You know, I work remotely, other people work remotely. It's a great opportunity to meet other people and to do that. So the social thing, like we are social beings. And like Orla said, it's good to get out and feel like strong and feel, you know, fit and healthy. And those are all good things. Where we can weave it in, it doesn't have to be all social, but I think where we can weave it in, it's always healthy because that's also a big part of, you know, just community and life that is that improves our health too. So finding the recipe and that recipe can change throughout the year, right? You might be very social one time of the year, less so the rest of the year. That's all good. And we can mix and match.
Ciarán, thank you so much for joining us. Always a pleasure chatting with you.
Likewise. Thank you so much. Have a great one.
You too. That's Ciarán Frail, behavioral scientist based in California. Coming up, the latest trend when it comes to all-inclusive resorts. But first, let's take a look at the roads.
Now trending with Andrea Elias and Orla Johannes on CJAD 800.
Welcome back. I'm Andrea along with Orla. So have you started to consider or even plan your next vacation? Well, something you might want to consider is the new trend when it comes to hotels and resorts. That's luxury all-inclusives. What does that mean and what should you be considering here? Montreal Gazette and Post Media travel columnist Rochelle Lash joins us now. Welcome back, Rochelle.
Thank you very much. There's a lot to talk about, Orla and Andrea, right in the middle of winter as it hits. We're talking about sun and sand.
Oh, I know.
You know, Club Med started the trend in the 50s. And a French company started in Spain with a small tented camp for young adventurers. And then the CEO explained to me how it sort of followed lifestyle and followed the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s. And it became, you know, kind of wild and crazy. And the geos half-dressed, wrapped in sarongs with the perfect tan and dancing till 5 in the morning. And then it went family in the 80s. And then Sandals decided that they could add an aspect to this, and so they made adult-only clubs with all that all-inclusive fun throughout the Caribbean. It's a Jamaican-based company, and a little more upscale and a little bit more expensive and still going strong. They have somewhere between 16 and 20 clubs throughout the Caribbean now.
So Rochelle, when we're talking about luxury all-inclusives, what exactly, like, what's the difference between a luxury all-inclusive and like a regular all-inclusive resort?
Well, I think once you're going sort of from 4-star to 5-star, well, both you should expect good food, decent food, and beautiful rooms, nice decor, and gorgeous landscaping at any resort in the Caribbean. I think that's prevalent. But you can expect better food and fancier decor and nicer bathrooms, for example, at a 5-star resort. Perhaps the staff is more polished. Perhaps there are more of them. And really, at a 5-star resort, you can expect just about, you know, you can ask anybody for anything. So that's pretty cool.
So we just came back from an all-inclusive resort in Mexico, and it's interesting, this transition, because now I'm seeing a lot of the traditional all-inclusives. You can choose between whether you want just regular or you want, they call it preferred star class, and it means that everybody gets the same scenery, the same food, but I love the fact with the star class, you get the butler service. You get somebody just helping you out with your reservations, your sunbeds. It seems that some of the resorts have started to incorporate that to take them to the luxury all-inclusive level, Rochelle.
They do have different levels at each resort, and some people like it, and some people kind of are a bit disappointed that they're not getting the same thing as everybody else. But you price your place, and then you can upgrade
right.
with the butler suite, the swim out suite, reservations at one or two of the restaurants, even though they're basically, the resort is basically reservation free. So I'll tell you that it kind of adds up a lot. And I think that you kind of keep your overhead low and you get the same facilities at a lower rate. But if you're really celebrating something or really trying to indulge, you can go for everything.
You're listening to Now Trending. I'm Andrea along with Orla. And we are speaking with Rochelle Lash, Montreal Gazette and Post Media travel columnist, about luxury all-inclusive resorts. So are they all the same, Rochelle? Like, how do you, if this is something that's interesting for you, how do you go about choosing the right one?
I think your first criterion has to be, do you want an adults-only resort or a family resort? And the decibel level has to be a lot different. Kids have their own agenda, and when they're let loose on the epic water parks and water slides at some of the family resorts, it's a whole different scene.
Definitely.
What I think is really cool is that a lot of the big brands like Hyatt, Hilton, and Marriott have adjacent resorts. One is adults only and one is family. So you can travel between the two, maybe a few hundred meters apart. There's probably a little trolley to take you, and it's kind of the model of play at one, stay at two, and then you double the number of restaurants and bars you can go to, and double the scene. So adults or family. You also want to choose perhaps on brand. For example, Margaritaville and Hard Rock Resorts, well, they just sound like fun, no matter where you are, and whether they're just the traditional hotels on the mainland or the, you know, new wave of all-inclusives. They're fun. They attract a young crowd. There's lots of partying. W could be more chic. Marriott's opening its first W hotel in the Dominican this year, and it will be the first W all-inclusive. So that might attract a certain crowd of, you know, maybe 25 to 45-year-olds. Maybe up your game just a little bit, and your best beach fashion and your best resort wear at night and so on. So branding's important, and branding is like godliness when it comes to loyalty programs. If you're a Marriott Bonvoy member, you'll be going to a Marriott club, which you can accrue points or spend points, depending on if you have to book on the Marriott website. For example, Hilton Honors has the same, and World of Hyatt is the same. So you'll probably be choosing, if you're a big traveler and a member of a international loyalty club, choosing also your favorite activity. I met people who were in Dominican Republic so that they could play golf at a Jack Nicklaus-designed course. They went every single morning to golf, and they were back at the all-inclusive club for lunch and the afternoon at the pool. And I met some guys who
amazing.
Were, yeah, kite surfing.
Let's go. Your
favorite activity, so like deep-sea diving, snorkeling, kite surfing, you might choose based on that.
So, Rochelle, when it comes to cost now, are the luxury all-inclusives more expensive than a traditional five-star hotel?
Well, you talked about upgrading with a butler and a, you know, suite, possibly with its own private plunge pool and that sort of thing. When you get into that, I think you're getting more expensive than a traditional five-star hotel.
Oh, interesting.
Hotel prices change daily, and they're based on availability. On the whole, I think it's a little less expensive to be at an all-inclusive, even though they're pricey at the luxury level, because I've roamed around a few posh hotels absolutely terrified to even ask for a ginger ale somewhere. God forbid it should be, you know, maybe $15 plus tax and tip. You never know. Ran away for a glass of water instead. So I think generally speaking, all inclusive, you have to make use of your facilities, enjoy yourself. And I think it's a little less expensive than a traditional five-star hotel where you're a la carte for everything.
So, Rochelle, I have to say, I'm not like a resort person so much. Like, it's been a long time since I've stayed at an all-inclusive. I like to kind of immerse myself in the culture when I go somewhere. But you say that you can still do this when staying at an all-inclusive. Is that right?
You can still do this. I think people feel that it's inauthentic to go to an all-inclusive and not be in a heart of a city or in a village. And that's true to a certain extent. But they also give you the opportunity to travel to countries where you might not normally go. I mean, there are all-inclusives in Turkey and Japan and China and Malaysia, and you're protected. And not everybody has the travel savvy to formulate a trip a la carte and handle museum tickets and flights and transportation from the airport and so on. So it's a good way to see countries that you wouldn't normally be able to see. And also, even if you're kind of in a regular place, you can leave the club for a day and go sightseeing. For example, Willemstad in Curaçao is a beautiful small city, very historic, 16th century, extremely charming. They have a lot of art and a lot of history. So you can go in there for half a day and lunch and dinner. You can take bike rides and boat excursions and sample local cuisine. And every all-inclusive also has a day devoted to the local culture. They'll have a craft fair and local foods. So, like, kind of a mini festival.
You know
so
what?
I think you get a taste of the country.
I think I'm sold. And maybe next time you're checking out these resorts, you might want to bring Orla and I along with you.
All right.
But wait. I love resorts. I'm going to be sunbathing somewhere, the headless sunbather, and you can check out your authenticity stuff. And I'll be there with my spicy mango margarita. You can get back to me.
Oh, well, that doesn't sound bad either. Rochelle, thank you. This has been great. Thank you so much for sharing all of your insight. We really appreciate your time.
I hope to talk again. Take care.
Absolutely. Bye. That's Montreal Gazette and Post Media travel columnist Rochelle Lash. Coming up, we'll take a look at some of the top wedding trends for 2024. But first, the latest from the CTV Montreal newsroom.
Welcome back. I'm Orla alongside Andrea. Now, did you know that December is the most popular month to pop the question? Well, if you or somebody you know got engaged last month, then a wedding may be in your future this year. So what are some of the top wedding trends for the couples and their guests in 2024? Alison McGill is a wedding expert and the host of Aisle Seat Podcast. Welcome back, Alison. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year, ladies. So happy to chat with you, as always, about all things weddings. It's a great year to get married. So many good things.
Yeah, so tell us about some of the exciting trends we can expect to see.
Well, I want to first off say, we talk about this a lot, but it seems to just get more and more important every year that couples are looking for celebrations that make their day hyper-personal. So it's what's going to make everything unique and bespoke, and that's a really important thing and concept for people planning their wedding days, and the guest experience is so important. So many of these things reflect back to all of that. Now, we're going to talk about fashion and some vibes that are happening. The first thing I want to talk about is anything but white wedding fashion. Now, that goes for men and for women.
Oh,
and I love this trend. So women, I mean, color has been on the radar for quite a while when we talk about wedding dresses, but we've been seeing lots of soft pastels like blues and pinks and lilacs, and we're seeing all of that, but we're seeing kind of everything. We're seeing, you know, peach fuzz, which is the Pantone color of the year, which is a big one. We're seeing gemstone hues. We're seeing neon tulle. It's pretty amazing. And if that's kind of not where you want to go for your whole wedding day, the good news is that we're now building a wardrobe of fashion for that day. So you might have a ceremony dress that's white, but a party dress that could be pink neon tulle. I love it.
Do you know that I bought a gray wedding dress? When I first went, I bought a Monique Lhuillier gray wedding dress. It came in white, ivory, and this gray. And I thought it was just the coolest thing. And did you know that I went home and I panicked for 2 months and finally called back and had them change the color of my dress to ivory. It was so cool. I didn't have the guts. I didn't have the guts to go through with it.
I
never knew that about you.
Yeah, I was like, I like completely, it was like the main thing about my wedding day that I cared the most about was the dress. And I don't think I would have regretted it, but at the time I was concerned.
But at the time, probably when you were married, the wedding wardrobe wasn't a thing because it's fairly new on the radar, I would say, since COVID, where people really want to change up their look. So you would have had that gray dress for your second look.
It's true. Yeah, but this was like my main, I only had the one look. But
yeah, me too.
Allison, I see we're also talking about 70s inspired weddings. What do you mean? What is that?
Isn't that fun? So the great thing about the 70s is, you know, it really has those two sides. So there's that sort of like boho, beautiful, natural, sort of cool love landscape. And then there's kind of the glam disco end of things. So it's a great decade to play in. This was actually one of Pinterest top trends for 2024, was groovy nuptials. I really like taking it in the direction of the more natural, the boho area. So we're talking about wedding dresses like with fringe, we're talking crochet, full sleeves, high necklines, suiting for women. And again, it's playing in these really fun color palettes. So it's primary browns, burnt orange, mustard, peach fuzz again, the Pantone color. So it's just a really fun element to bring into the day. And think about all like the cultural touchstones and the music you can have for this party.
Allison, can I honestly ask you, though, I mean, how excited would you be to get into browns and oranges on your wedding day? Like, honestly, I wouldn't be too thrilled.
They'd have a renaissance. I mean, for bridesmaids, like burnt cinnamon and sage and mustard and marigold, all of those tones are super huge. So I feel that those of us have kind of lived through it the first time, we might not be excited about it. But they really do feel fresh again because we really haven't seen them done in a fashion-forward way for such a long time.
I you know what? One thing my best friend had said to me when I got married, she said, Orla, do not put me in plaid. I don't want any Scottish kilt-looking things on me. But if I told her now I'm going to put you in orange and rust, I don't think she'd show up. It's interesting how the trends change, you know?
Well, I mean, it's full circle. I mean, I don't think the 70s have really been having a moment. We've been so back to the 90s, back to the 80s, and now we're throwing it back even further. It's kind of fun, done in a modern way. I'm with you. Brown is not my first choice either. but it's really like done in accent shades. But I do really love these like earthy tones. They do feel fresh after seasons of white and green and gold. It's just something different.
I like I'm really into like a rich brown this season, I have to say. And I would take that over like some of the pale bridesmaids dresses I've been put in over the years any day. Allison, I see another one of your trends is bows. And I know we've seen this across the fashion world as well. Like, what are we talking about when we say bows?
Right. It's this whole idea of this coquette aesthetic that really took off on social media, I'd say, just before Christmas. So we're seeing bows on everything. Bows and bridal are not new in the fashion capacity. So we've seen everything on dress sleeves, necklines, waistlines, gloves, veils, jewelry. But we're really into this maximalist moment. So it's sort of this very feminine, fun, taking that bow into the decor story. Lots of ribbons tied around your candles and napkins, just really taking it a bit over the top. And I think with the next season of Bridgerton coming out, it's very fueled by that, and it's only going to get bigger.
I just love bows. I mean, I remember when they came out in like late 80s, you got Sarah Ferguson there, you know, always wearing a bow in her hair and then bows. It was just bows everywhere. I love a pretty little bow. I'm just looking at your list here now, Allison, and there's one very interesting trend that I want to ask you about, and that's love heart shaped rings. Is this, to me, says after a few years, because it's not classic enough, you're going to want to change it?
The heart cut diamond engagement ring we're talking about. Absolutely. Right. I hear you on that, Orla. It's very specific, isn't it? But we've been in this season of fancy shapes. So we've seen the oval, we've gone to the pear, we are now seeing marquee cuts. The heart is something that's not conventional. It goes back again to that idea of something that is not expected. And to really look specifically at a heart cut diamond, this cut on that stone has incredible dazzle and fire to it, which a lot of people don't realize because we're a little bit caught up thinking it might be a little too cliche or a little too cute. But it really is a beautiful stone. I encourage people to check it out. Again, it goes back to sort of that coquette aesthetic. And a nice way to do that heart shape so that you maybe don't tire of it is to set it in a two-stone setting. So a trois and a moi ring, as we like to call it. So it could be an oval paired with a heart-shaped diamond or an emerald-cut diamond in a heart. But again, it makes it a little bit more timeless, so you won't tire of it.
You're listening to Now Trending. I am Andrea, along with Orla, and we are speaking with Allison McGill, wedding expert and the host of the Aisle Seat podcast, about 2024 wedding trends. So, Allison, if a big over-the-top wedding is not your thing, apparently getting married at City Hall might be a good option.
It's a great option, and it's very, very in right now. It's one of the coolest, most elegant, chicest days you can have. It's something especially for you. I'm going to reference a celebrity couple. Naomi and Billy Crudup got married at a New York courthouse, Naomi Watts, last year. She wore an Oscar de la Renta dress. He had a suit. They looked incredibly chic. It was very private. They just released some photos on Instagram. It was a date just for them. So that sort of spirit is continuing. People are still very much into the intimate wedding and love the idea of celebrating with just the two of you.
And if you do decide to have a bigger wedding, apparently a zero-proof bar is also trending this year.
It is. We are seeing such a cultural shift towards non-alcoholic lifestyles, and couples are going all in for this if that is something that they embrace and support. And having a completely alcohol-free, dry affair.
Goodness me, this is quite the trend. I'm sorry, Allison, I have to pick myself up off the ground here with this. What with your 70s bridesmaids dresses, your heart-shaped rings, and now
Orla can't even have a sherry.
I can't even have a drink in the dress.
Times are changing, ladies.
It's true.
Clearly. But I mean, what about doing zero proof one side and maybe none the other side? So people that, you know, aren't following a no alcohol policy can have a drink.
I don't know. There were some people at my wedding that I would have liked to have a no alcohol policy on.
Absolutely. I mean, there are choices. This is what we're talking about. Because before we were talking about non-alcoholic beverages being a Diet Coke and some Perrier. And so we're very far down the road with that now. There's so many alcohol-free spirits, champagnes, wine. And, you know, I have heard of lots of couples going completely dry with their weddings. And it speaks back to the personalization and things that are important to people and their values. This is what's happening. And I support it because it's your day. You should have it your way.
That's really interesting because, you know, when I got married, Allison, I was kind of guided down the road of we're gonna choose things for the guests. The meal has to go around the guests, the everything, the food, what would they like? And it's so interesting how it's now flipped the other way. It's more about what the couple wants. And as a guest, you show up to their party, not I'm throwing a party so that everybody can, you know, be happy with it. It's very interesting how it's like, you know, roles reversed now.
I think it should be like this. I think I like it. I think, I mean, it is about celebrating the couple, right?
There's different cultures where people expect, you know, the good food, the good alcohol.
Absolutely. So these are talking points, and these are interesting things that have now entered the chat when it comes to wedding planning. There's a lot more options and there's a lot more transparency, I would say, on the table when we're talking about these sorts of things.
Yes.
And what I was going to say leading into that, talking about the guest experience, is another trend that's happening is guest dressing mood boards. Yes, that's right. Telling your guests how to dress for the wedding, because I know that we have talked before about what to wear to a wedding. So this is, again, making the guest experience a little simpler because you're going to tell them straight out of the gate what the dress code is and some ideas of what they should wear. Some people might find this a little offensive. I personally think it's great because how many times have we personally struggled and thought, okay, we're going formal, but what does that mean?
Oh my God, for sure. The second I get an invitation to anything, I start panicking about what I'm going to wear.
Yes,
somebody sent me a mood board. Oh, it's my dream. Send me a link.
Therapy.
I'll click the link and order the outfit. Like, I'm on board for this 100%.
Oh goodness, Alison, always a pleasure as always. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, ladies.
That's Alison McGill, wedding expert and the host of Aisle Seat Podcast. Coming up, just how healthy is salmon? And are all the varieties created equal? But first, let's take a look at the roads.
Now trending with Andrea Elias and Orla Johannes on CJAD 800.
Welcome back. I'm Andrea along with Orla. So we constantly hear doctors and nutritionists telling us how great salmon is for us. But when it comes to choosing the right type, it can be confusing, right? Because there's so many varieties to choose from. You've got sockeye, coho, wild, farmed, organic. Like, are they all equal? And what should we be looking for? Stephanie Colombo is an associate professor and research chair in aquaculture nutrition at Dalhousie University. And she joins us now. Thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
So off the bat, what do we know about why salmon is such a nutritional powerhouse?
Well, first of all, it contains some essential nutrients. So take your essential omega-3 fatty acids. And some people would even take fish oil pills just to get that alone. But it's such a nutritional powerhouse, as some people would call it, because not only are you getting your essential omega-3s, but you're also getting excellent protein, essential amino acids, vitamins, minerals. So for every bite you're taking, you're getting a very dense nutritional source.
You know, my Labrador takes more salmon pills than any of the humans in our house, actually. She's the important one. So let's talk about the difference between wild and farmed and organic. I hear the same question, and a lot of people think they're all one, but they are not, right?
That's right. I can definitely clear that up, and it is confusing. When you go in the grocery store, there's so many different options and it's not very clear. So wild and farmed. Farmed means that it was grown, it was farmed. It's not being fished or harvested from the wild. Now there's different types. So most of the farmed fish that we have, farmed salmon that we have around the world, are farmed Atlantic salmon. That is a certain species of salmon. Now, wild salmon, that might be different species. So that could be wild sockeye, wild Chinook. These are different species and not all salmon are the same. Organic is always farmed in Canada. And that means that it had to adhere to specific standards about how it was raised, like its diet. It was never fed any antibiotics and things like that. So organic is also farmed, but it just means that it was grown in a certain way.
And when it comes to the health benefits, are they all equal or, you know, in an ideal situation, should we be choosing one over another?
They are all excellent nutritional sources. And we've done a couple of studies in my lab comparing different species, wild and farmed, organic versus not organic. And any of these that you pick, you're going to get the nutritional benefits from them. Now, I had some recommendations based on the studies that we have done. For example, for people that are often eating salmon, like maybe once a week or a couple times a week, I would go for farmed Atlantic because of the lower cost and also the very high nutritional density. So again, for every bite you're taking, you're getting a lot of nutrients. Wild Pacific, for example, is very lighter, so you're getting less fat and a little bit more protein and is less nutrient dense. Another option would be sockeye and Chinook. Now these had the highest omega-3s. So for people that don't often eat a lot of fish or don't often eat a lot of salmon, maybe once a month or less, I would go for the wild sockeye because for every bite you're taking, you're getting the most nutrients. But also, you know, not everyone can be eating wild sockeye all the time because there's sustainable limits to how much we can catch from the wild. And also, it's very expensive, so it's not very affordable. So for less frequent consumption, I would go for something like wild Chinook or sockeye. But for those that are eating it pretty often, I would go for farmed Atlantic.
You're listening to Now Trending. I'm Orla alongside Andrea, and we are chatting with Stephanie Colombo, an associate professor and research chair in aquaculture nutrition at Dalhousie University, and we're talking about salmon. So let's talk about smoked salmon. Is there a difference between fresh salmon and smoked salmon? Like, should we be going again for the sockeye? Has that got less mercury? Because a lot of times you hear that word, mercury, mercury, stay away from salmon. No, you can have this salmon, it's got less mercury. Can you break that down for us?
So about mercury, Health Canada does have an advisory for seafood for mercury. So we should watch for the different types of seafood that we eat, especially if we're eating them very often. Salmon is not on that list. Swordfish and tuna are on that list, for example. For any of the salmon types that I've analyzed in my lab, mercury was very low. There's some slight differences, but I never have any concern about frequently eating salmon.
Okay. So when it comes to smoking, I'm just, you know, being in Montreal, it's something, it's on a lot of people's tables.
Oh, I love smoked salmon.
Do you know if we lose the nutritional components in the smoking process?
That's a great question. I was just looking into this the other day. That was not part of the studies that I've done, but I think the next study I'm going to look at different types of preparation and how they affect the nutritional value. Now, smoked in particular, I'm not sure, but I was looking at a couple of other studies, and there is a difference between baking, frying, boiling, sous vide, so this sashimi, just eating it raw. There are some differences. Not hugely different, though, and smoking is something I haven't looked into. It's not to say it hasn't been analyzed yet, but I'm actually not sure. But again, I would say compared to your other protein options that you're going to get in your meals, regardless of how you prepare it, you're still getting a lot of nutrients and some unique nutrients that you would get from other protein sources like chicken or beef, especially the omega-3 fatty acids.
Many people are also becoming more aware of the ecological impact of what we eat. And, you know, we've heard about the over-farming of salmon. How does this compare to other animal sources of protein in terms of impact?
Yeah, that's a comparison that's been done in recent years, looking at what is the carbon footprint? What is the environmental impact on freshwater use? And aquaculture comes out on top compared to poultry production, compared to beef and other mammal production. So farming in the sea is definitely a lower impact. I mean, let's face it, any type of agriculture, whether it be animal agriculture or plant agriculture, is going to have some impact on the environment. Now, we also need to eat food. So it's really about that balance of having the less amount of environmental impact compared to the most amount of food and nutritious food we can produce. And you know, no form of agriculture is perfect, and there are differences between some type of aquaculture compared to others. Salmon reared in the ocean versus salmon reared on land-based. And so there are a lot of differences. However, the main take-home message that I would want to tell people is that any form of aquaculture is always comes out on top in terms of lower environmental footprint compared to other forms of animal agriculture. And there are many studies that show this.
Wow, that's been incredibly enlightening. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Stephanie Colombo, Associate Professor and Research Chair in Aquaculture Nutrition at Dalhousie University. And thank you so much for spending part of your Sunday with us. We'll be back at the same time next week. In the meantime, you can follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Now Trending Show. Have a fabulous week.